I don't want to. I was going to be a little aggressive and talk about Yiftach and Shimshon. We'll probably only deal with Yiftach because there's plenty there to keep us busy. Last week we really did. There were four big aspects with Yiftach. One is understanding the whole political situation with Amon and Moab versus Israel, and what's the old conflict. And the old conflict actually goes back to Yitziat Mitzrayim, where they're going through the territory. We had maps. It's very nice. Hope it's very nice. oh, thank you. we also, the second thing we dealt with was, and of course 2 weeks ago we dealt with the issue of tribalism. Oh, last week we dealt with a very, very important issue, which was the fact that Menashe and Ephraim are trying to kill each other. And what we showed was it wasn't really Menashe and Ephraim like Gidon, but it was Menashe and Ephraim as in one side of the river and the other side of the river. And we presented the idea that the conflict between Ephraim and Menashe goes back to the point where Ephraim was very upset. If you remember in Sefer Yosua, Ephraim was very upset that Menashe got extra land, because they said, I'm the bigger tribe, where's my extra land? Why did they feel that way? Because Menashe had two portions of land. And it was Ephraim that was supposed to have two portions of land, and Menashe won. So I heard from Yaakov Meidan that actually Ephraim had taken over some of the territory from Menashe on the other side of the river. And essentially you have a conflict which is long-standing between one side of the Jordan River and the other side of the Jordan River. We explored some of that. The only thing, and that really finished up Yiftach, Perek Yud-Aleph and Perek Yud-Bet. We simply skipped about six or seven psukim in Yud-Aleph that deals with Yiftach's daughter and what happens to her. So that's where I'd like to pick up now. Do you want to, you're just going to do it by ear? I'll do one extra.
Sorry, I'll do it by ear.
Okay, so I have this.
I
didn't bring enough. I usually bring extra Tanakh, but...
I should have brought my own, I didn't think.
There's also a living Tanakh there in English. Oh, is that a living Tanakh? Just a second, let me see if
it's
a
Does anyone use Avenue to Yangu's Road in the morning?
I used to, but I was traded.
Oh, you traded your Avenue to Torah in the morning now?
Yeah.
Okay. let's read through the psukim. The first psukim I actually put. Oh, hand out.
What comes to the
It's true.
I'll tell you what. We're in chapter 11, verse 30.
I hope you wanted to be quoted or something.
Chapter 11. Chapter 11, that's something to listen to here also. Chapter 11, verse 30 in Shoftim, and we're really only doing six psukim, but they're very difficult psukim, so I thought I'd just read through the whole of the psukim. Some of them I have photocopied here. Let me get my place in my Tanakh.
So then you're not even missing.
No.
A little. I have a few psukim. I didn't quote everything, but I'll read it all out loud, because it's not much. Starting from... Well, I could start a pasuk earlier on verse 29 of chapter 11. Vatihi al Yiftach ruach Adonai, vayavor et Gilad v'et Menashe, vayavor et mishpei Gilad v'mishpei Gilad avar bnei Amon. So he crossed over. This is verse 29, chapter pasuk chafet, perek Yud-Aleph, 11:29. And we discussed the idea of the mitzvahs. That was 2 weeks ago. The three different mitzvahs that may have been going on. So I'm not going to focus on this pasuk since I think we did it. Lamed vayidar. Yiftach neder, he takes a vow, Lashem vayomar, and he says, Im naton titene bnei Amon biyadi, if you give over bnei Amon into my hands, that is, if I win the war, vaya yotze asher yetze, midaltei beti lekrati, whoever leaves my house to greet me, b'shuvi b'shalom, b'nei shalom, on my way back from the war, vaya l'adonai, it will be for God, v'alitihu olah, and I will raise it up as a burnt offering. What's that? Is it? For which?
I don't know.
I have it in the back, which I can go up to look up. It's pretty famous. The simple pshat of the pasuk, of course, is that whatever comes out of the house, I will, A, give it to God, and in detail, what I will do is I will give it as a burnt offering. We'll ask questions of, is that what he meant? What was he expecting? And we'll analyze all those issues, because I know this is a hot topic.
Expecting a land to
work out? Right, correct. And we'll see whether it fits in all the different understandings, the Chazal weigh in, their various mafarshim, and we'll analyze everybody. And then, pasuk
grammatical question? Not a substantive question, a grammatical.
Go ahead.
The break between pasuk lamed and lamed aleph.
Probably there's a break between lamed and lamed aleph as part of a shavua. A shavua is usually a two-part deal. One is the condition. If this is what will happen, then I will do that. So they're usually two distinct parts of a neder. I don't think they always show up in two different psukim, but they do really constitute two parts of a statement. If you do this for me, then I will do that for you. And those two things are easily broken up by psukim, even though it looks like it's one sentence, it breaks up nicely as two, simply because of the standard neder approach. And I think that you'll probably find that in other places in the Dharma, although not all. Now, verse 32 and verse 33 are the battle. That's it. You know, if you think about it, if you look at Gideon's battle, which is chapter long, and Devorah's battle, which is two chapters long, most of the significant battles take some time. Here, we take a short jump to a two-pasuk battle, and Yiftach was successful. And then in Pasuk Lamed Aleph, verse 34, he's home and hears the rest of the playing out of the neder. What that means is Shmuel is not focused on the battle. He couldn't care less about the battle because the success of Yiftach as a military man is probably not in question. It's not an issue. The question of leadership, which is what Sefer Shulchan is all about, is not about whether he was a successful warrior. It focuses on the issue of the neder and how he deals with the neder between he and what happens with his daughter. And you get a sense of that simply because you have the neder, a quick jump to battle, which is way short, and then a return of a focus to the neder, as if 32 and 33, which discuss the battle, are simply a short intermission to the main point. In fact, if you take a look at the end of 32 and 33 are really in the wrong place. They're simply in the wrong place. If you take a look at 33, the last few words are Vayikan'u b'nei Amon mipnei b'nei Yisrael. That's usually the end. That's the end of a prophetic cycle. If we take a look at the Devorah and we take a look at Yiftach, that's the end of the cycle. There's nothing more to talk about, really. That's what happens after the battle is you know, that's the summation.
They were suppressed.
They were underneath. And this shows up by Devorah. So you have a whole battle story and all the conversations, etc., etc. And then the battle story ends off with that, and then that's it. You go to the next shofet.
And usually it actually ends with, and there was peace for so many years.
Why don't we take a look back instead of me just stating, let's see, you know, sometimes I get these theories wrong. If we take a look at, if we want to jump around a little bit, chapter 4, verse 24 is Barak and Devorah. So there are two stories, of course. With the second song, you don't get the idea of one being suppressed by Israel. That comes in chapter 4, verse 24, which says, "Vatelech yad ben Yisrael halofu kashal yavim melech Kanan, ad asher chritu et yavim melech Kanan." End of story. Now, it's true, we go back to sing the song, but to see the singing of the song is a retelling of what happened before. The narrative ends with, and they won, and their enemies were suppressed, and you're right, and there was peace in the land, which is what happens at the end of chapter 5. If we take a look at, actually before that, let's look at Ehud's time. Ehud ben Gera, the famous left-hander. If you look in chapter 3, verse 30, after the long story and the bloody assassination, he runs back, and they take the ford. So if you look in chapter 3, verse 30, it says, "Vatikana Moav bayomahu," and they were, Moav was suppressed in that day, "Tacha Yisrael, vatishkod haaretz, shmonim shana," end of story. That's the end of Ehud. Just as it's the end of Devorah. Devorah, you also have an insertion, which is the song, but essentially that's where it ends. And I believe that if we look through, that will really be the cycle for most of these. Take a look if you want to go back to the one before Ehud. So we have Otniel ben Kenaz. So please take a look at chapter 3, verse 10, 11.
The same verb is used here also. Kanai.
Oh yeah, very common. Vayikanu. Yeah, I guess we can analyze the question of why singular and why plural and who's the focus, the king or the people, but the same word. That's the symbolism that essentially seals up these prophets. Everything is okay, end of story. So if you take a look at 3:10-11, it says, Vatishkot, it's at the very end of verse 10 in chapter 3. It says, Vayitein Milchamah, they went to war, Vayitein Biyad Kushan Rishatayim Melech Aram, Vataj Yadol Al Kushan Rishatayim Vatishkot Aretz Arvim Shana, Vayamad Otniel Ben Kenaz, end of story. Now, there's no question. Now, if you look
in chapter 13.
Go ahead.
Parak 7. No, it's the end of Yiftach.
Yes.
So in 7, it says in English, and then, you know, they killed the 42,000 in Ephraim. Then it says, Yiftach judged Israel for 6 years. But then it says, which is unusual, so that I think is generally the end, that it ends up
12, 7.
Pardon me?
12:7.
Ah, you're right.
Yes,
12:7.
Go ahead.
Then Yiftach the Gilead, he died and was buried in one of the cities of Gilead. And then it ends.
Right.
Usually it doesn't tell you he died.
Well, sometimes
but
it does. Bayoni Ben Kanash it did.
All right. But what I'm saying is that I was suggesting that the end of it is they have the battle, and then it says, and he judged for so many years, and usually it says, and there was peace. But it doesn't say that here, but at the very end of Yiftach, except for the burying him, says, and he judged for only 6 years. But, you know, so I think the formula where they had the battle, and then he judged for so many years, was interrupted by more battle. There was a civil war, but it really ends with, and he judged for so many years.
That's correct, but the standard seal, in fact, I would have said that it's Shmuel writing the Sefer, if I may be so audacious as to say, when he was putting together the Sefer, before he decided to put in the Neder piece and the Civil War piece, I mean, it's a risky thing to put in to say that essentially one Jew, you know, one set of Jews killed 40,000 another set of Jews. Shmuel must have been thinking, do I write this or do I not write this? How do I want my book? What message do I... Well, that's not really fair. It was from Nevuah. So God was saying, this is the message you have to deliver. But Shmuel, in the process of writing that, must be going through a series of... must be going through a series of writings trying to figure out how to best to express the message that God has told him to do. If you ask me how the story would go, I would say, go back to 11:28. V'lo shama melech b'nei Amon el divrei Yiftach asher shalach elav. Amon did not listen to him. And then jump from 28 to 32, and there's even a break there. You see, there's a parshiyah break. Then it says, v'yorevor Yiftach el b'nei Amon lihilachem ba'am. Cross over to fight. Which is in chapter 33, and then we should have immediately jumped to the very end, chapter 12, verse 3, which means, and there's even the breaks, as you can see very nicely in my parshiot, it should have gone from here directly to there, and it inserted the piece about the Neder. Then, of course, you don't understand the Neder unless you put the battle in, of course, right? Because it wouldn't make sense that you don't know he's successful, so you don't know why he's sacrificing his daughter. So you have to reinsert the daughter. And then he's saying, well, I started talking about the Neder, let's talk about the Civil War. So and then we'll do the Civil War, and then we'll get back to the natural formula. So essentially, in the natural reading, Shmuel has inserted two stories which divide the natural flow of every Shofet. He won the war, Vatichna at the enemy under the hands of the Jews, and he ruled for X years, and the land was quiet for X years. And in between that, literally in the middle of the Pasuk, he inserts these stories. To my mind, to make sure that we understand that the battle for Yiftach is not the issue. The issue is the Neder that he made. That's our problem with Yiftach. The Civil War is easy to understand. We discussed it yesterday. And it's important, as last week. And as I mentioned, the importance is not just to show that Yiftach was a thug, because according to Barvanella, it wasn't so much Yiftach's fault, it was Ephraim's fault. And we discussed that last week. It's Ephraim that said, I'm going to burn your house down. That's the way they started their parlay. So the Barvanella and others say, don't blame Yiftach so much. Look at Ephraim. They were no great shakes themselves. That's easily understood why the Navi needs to break this up. But what about this Neder? Do I really need to know? I'm writing a book about failed kings. What do I really need to know? What? Gideon never had personal, he never yelled at his wife or had problems with his kids. Okay, he makes a neder. All right, I understand. His daughter goes out. It's a very sad story. Boo-hoo-hoo. This is not a harlequin romance. It has to be supporting the main focus of the book, which is to show how kings fail. And then how is that? Okay, so you say we really need to see what a non-frum guy he is. They would make a neder, sacrifice his daughter. But we're not even sure that's what happened. It's not clear. The words are constructed in such a way that it becomes very unclear what exactly is being lost, whether it's her life or the fact that she'll never have a guy forever and ever. Not only that, we already, when it comes to his religiosity, we already presented that in his conversation, his parlay with Moab. That is, this is clearly a focus story, and that's why I think it's important to recognize it in light of the overall understanding of where the book wants to take us. And with that, what I'd like to do is I'd like to read you, I guess the real problem that we deal with is what promise was he making? And the way to attack that is to look at the words themselves and then also to look at what happened when he has to perform the act he has to perform to keep his neder. So if we go back to verse 31, V'haya yotzei asher yetzei midalpei beiti, that which comes out from my house, l'krati, v'shuvi b'shalom, when I come back in peace, mibnei Amon, Vayala Dunai Vahalitiu Ola, and I will raise it as a sacrifice. That word va is what's called the copulative vav. It means and, which means the subject of the verbs of what's going on are the same, which is A, I will do to my, whatever comes out of my house, A, I will give it to God. And what I'm trying to tell you is B, and then what I'm trying to tell you is that I will sacrifice it to Hashem. Which means essentially he's promising human sacrifice.
Well,
not only if he thinks that it's
I'm sorry, you're right. I apologize. Let me step back. He's whatever it is that came out of his house, and one could, you're right, one could say that he was expecting an animal to come out of his house, and we'll analyze whether that's a realistic expectation or not, that he was, the act was of sacrifice, but certainly he's taking a risk. There's certainly a risk there either way. And actually there's a double risk, which we'll see as we go through these mufarshim. Let's take a look at the Radak. The Radak gives an interesting parish. V'ha'alitihu ola. I will raise it up as a sacrifice. I'm sorry, I'm on page number one of the handouts.
Yes.
I have more.
Yes.
Do you have, everybody have, do you have handouts? Line number 11. The Radak says, V'ha'alitihu tihu ola. Dat razal b'zeh yadua. The thoughts of our Rabotenu Zechonam v'bracha are no. He's not going to address those. I'll show you what those thoughts are. To give you a hint, they felt that she died.
Mm.
That's what she felt. And I'll prove it to you from Divrei Chazal, although they're also rather circumspect about it. You have to read it into the words, but I think you'll find that it's convincing. Va'adoni Avi Zal, my father, David Kimsky's father, was a famous grammarian and a scholar in his own right. Pirish Vehelitihu Havav Bimkom O. It's not a copulative vav. It's an orva, this or that, which means I will give it to whatever comes out of my house, I will give it to God, or I will raise it as a sacrifice. And I'll explain what that means. V'hayal Hashem hekdesh im enoi ra'oi lola. If it's not appropriate to give it to God, then I'll simply make it hekdesh, I'll make it holy. Im ra'oi lola, and if whatever comes out of my house is appropriate for a sacrifice, then I will bring it up to a... So essentially, he gives himself a way out. And by the way, it's not necessarily human. We'll see that Chazal bring up the issue. If a chamor comes out of his house, that chamor will work in the Beit HaMikdash and make it holy, and it serves whatever carrying in the Beit HaMikdash for the rest of his life. That's what I do with it. And if it's a kosher animal, then I'll give it as a sacrifice. But I want to make sure that in some way, anything that comes out of my house becomes holy. Sounds pretty firm, right? Pretty firm. Essentially what the Radak has made is, not only is Yiftach incredibly intelligent, he's covered all his bases, he's a very firm guy. He wants to make sure that no matter what happens, whatever animal at least you can say comes out of his house, he gives it to God. It's a very firm thing. So is he. The Kamoze Vav Makah Aviv Vi'imo, just like we have somebody who hits his mother and his father, obviously the person to be punished does not need to hit his mother and his father, but O will suffice, one or the other, O'imo. The Yafet Perish. And my father did a good job with his translation. And that's the way it seems later on. Because it doesn't say he kills her. Sha'amar, what does she say? Yiftach Dora says, it doesn't say I'm going to go cry for my life. Because he didn't kill her. What does it say? Va'avke al betulati, I will cry for my virginity, or that's the way we would normally translate Tulati. Ach lo yada ish, she simply became a nun. Kamosha amar, vihi lo yada ish. Umasha amar gamke vayasla et nidro asher nadar. That he does the neder, which he says. Obviously, if he promised that he was going to do something and he didn't kill her, it's all based on the idea. Radak is all based on this idea that for sure he didn't kill her. And therefore, since for sure he didn't kill her, and the Pasuk says that he kept his neder, it must be that the promise was not to kill her. Otherwise, he wouldn't have kept his neder, and you can't make that statement about Yiftach. And therefore, he changes the condition of the promise. Either I sacrifice it or I make a kodesh. That's exactly what I did. And the Torah compliments him. Yiftach, what a great guy. He did exactly what he was supposed to do. V'lo amar v'yale ola le'ot, ki prusha haita, not sacrifice her, she was simply a nun. V'zeu nidro Hashem adar, and that's exactly the promise he kept. V'yal Hashem, and she became destined for God. She was married to God. Kach nifel lefi pshat ha'psukim v'divrei Razal But the Divrei Chazal, as I mentioned, said they killed her in Kabbalah, if that's what they received, the Adam in their hands, Aleinu the Kabbalah, we have to accept it. You see, it's very interesting, right? It's the famous conflict between Pshat and Divrei Chazal. So he's saying Chazal, who said that she was killed, that's not Pshat. I'm telling you Pshat, which he proves from the fact of what actually happens to her. And they're giving you a medrash, and you have to understand if that's what they said, if that's what happened, what are you going to do? You have to accept it. So he plays this game the Radak does between medrash and pshat. But the truth is, again, I want to take you back to that first pasuk. The vav is normally a copy of the levav, which means zehali tiru l'Hashem. And therefore, Chazal are basing the simple pshat. Sure, you could change a vav to an o. You could do that. But you only do that when you have to do it. The natural pshat of the first pasuk is that she was, that the promise was to kill her. And then Radak has a question, then how come it focuses on her virginity? We never know exactly what happens to her. We simply don't know. But why the focus on her virginity, which is a good question, if in fact she died, then why are we crying about that? We should be crying about her death. And what I'll show you is Chazal, I believe, have the right shot, and I'll explain to you why the virginity is an issue, even though her life was taken away. But in order to show you Chazal, let's take a look at the words of Chazal. That will be on line number 20. Oh, you know what, before I do that, I have to read you this fascinating Ramban. Perushel Ramban on Nevi'im Ketuvim. This is how much he wrote on Nevi'im and Ketuvim. Not a heck of a lot, but very important. So when he does comment, he absolutely has something to say. And he certainly has something to say here, so let me read it to you. This is one of the few things he says on Sefer Shem. I'm sorry I don't have a photocopy, so I'll read it slowly. Al tiyeh nifateh. Do not be seduced, the Ramban says, the Hevle Rebbe Avraham, with the nonsense of Rebbe Avraham. That's Eben Ezra. Now we, by the way, don't have the Eben Ezra. He wrote a parish, obviously, on Shoftim, which is sad. You know, you read this stuff and it makes you cry a little bit, because obviously Eben Ezra wrote a parish on Shoftim, but we don't have it. But Radak will say the same thing that Eben Ezra does, as you see in a second. Va'omer he'eli ve'heli tiyu lo'ola, and, or, I will raise it up to a sacrifice, Lomar imia yotzei midalte beiti ish o isha, if a human being comes out, vayal Hashem kodesh, which means he goes further than the Radak's father. Radak just says if it's inappropriate for an olah, which means it could be a chamor or a gamal or whatever it is. Apparently Rabbi Avraham actually said if a human comes out, the human becomes hekdesh, v'sheyeh preirush midarche olam, she has to sit in a nunnery, or he has to sit totally separated from the rest of the world, La'mod l'sharet b'shem Hashem b'tfilah v'odol elokim. She has to sit around and do nothing but pray all day and all night. A monastic existence. Thank you. V'im yed devar yu'ayu l'karev eleinu olah. And if it comes out nice and kosher, up it goes. V'asha beita beit l'bito. This is, he's still quoting the Eben Ezra. And he made a house for his daughter, a nunnery, or a convent. Michutz la'ir, outside the city, v'hid bodadasham, and she was by herself there, v'kil kalah, kol yaman, and he paid for it. He said he kept her in money. She had what to eat. V'ish lo yada, and no man would know her, v'hayta b'tot surah, and her daughter was chained up. That probably has connotations of, what is it called? A chastity belt. Probably something, I don't know for sure. V'eila divrei ruach. These words are the words of wind. What he's saying is that the Ramban says is a lot of hot air. Ki'im nadar sheyel Hashem einenu sheyel parush, and he brings a great thing. Just because somebody's for God, that doesn't mean he's never with people. Not only that, here's the amazing. What are you going to say? That's correct. It's true. It's not exactly the same. So there's a better deduction actually you could bring, and that's the center. You have to watch Divrei Chazal because they always know what they're talking about, even though they're subtle. Anybody know the famous Mishnah? Yiftach b'doro ke Shmuel. Why Shmuel? Why not Gidon or somebody else? What's the issue with Shmuel, which the Ramban's going to bring? What did his mother do? His mother said, if you give me this son, I will give him to God all his days. The words aren't exactly the same, but they're quite similar, which if you have a Tanakh, you'll say quite similar. He had sons. He worked in the Beit HaMikdash all his life, there's no question about it. But he wasn't Parush. His mother
not
came up
was.
To visit.
He was an itinerant preacher.
What's that?
More
so
than
and a nubby, that's right. And he didn't live in a monastery. He had kids. His mother visited him on a regular basis. He went around to be a shofet for all the people. He was certainly not living a monastic existence.
Wasn't Shin Shon also dedicated to Hashem?
He was a Nazir, probably a different level. This seems to be, you know, a more of a Kedusha. But even if you want to say this higher level Kedusha, we have an example, which is Shin Shon Bedaro. And now you have to start to make a comparison between what Yiftach did with his neder and what Shmuel's mother did, and the consequences of Shmuel's mother with her neder. And we'll get back to that. But they're very subtle Chazal, right? Because normally you read the Chazal and just say, okay, good generation, bad generation. But what they're trying to focus you on is the neder issue. So let's continue on, because it's terrific stuff. Ve'elu divrei ruach, im nadar shielo enenu shiye parush, doesn't mean you don't become a priest. And by the way, the Ramban knows full well the Christian movements of the time, and he is probably very disturbed. I should tell you that Ibn Ezra, I don't know if Ibn Ezra was affected by the fact that he lived in Rome, but he ended his life in Rome. He wrote most of his perushim in Rome. He was certainly under the, he was certainly influenced, I don't want to say chas v'shalom, but we're in the same way that we're influenced by culture around us. He was certainly not blind to culture around him. Probably the idea of chastity belt was a medieval concept. I'm not sure it really dates back. It's hard to say. I certainly can't recall anything in Tanakh which talks about chastity belt, but this surah reminds me of something out of Christendom. And Ibn Ezra is certainly well within his right to use the knowledge of his time to try to understand the pshat.
What time
frame are you talking about? Ibn Ezra wrote 1100 to... I believe 1090 to 1160, and Ramban about 1160 to 1220. Those are vague numbers.
Rashi was also 1100.
Rashi was earlier. It was 1040 to 1110 or so. A little earlier, 1026 or 1036. I think Ibn Ezra, if I'm not mistaken, was 14 years old. I'm sorry, Rashi was 14 years old when Ibn Ezra was born, if I remember. I have a very hard time with these dates. By and large, Ramban is really 13th century, and Rashi and Ibn Ezra are really 11th century. Even though there's only about 150 years between them, they straddle the two centuries. Ukefi mishpateya Torah in biyad adam sheyidur biyotzei petach beito sheyu prushim. There's no such halacha. Kasher im biyadolat lotomola. You can't do such a thing. Let me just scan on, because I don't want to take too much time. Oh, yeah. The davar kain, and if you're going to say it's true that she lived a monastic and a virginal life like a nun, haita bito habochel b'tuleha, his daughter who cries on her virginity, v'reoteha, if you remember her friends, we'll read inside, come, ima tizonot v'kaleshetnan. They're not doing a wonderful thing. They're cursing her. What kind of situation is that where you take a human being, a girl, and you force her to live a monastic life? And her friends are coming. Let's read the psukim inside. Let's take a look at what happens with the girls, so we know what Ramban's talking about. If you look in Pasuk Lamatet, verse 39, Vayihi mikeit shnayim chodashim, she gets 2 months. She asks her father for 2 months reprieve. So first of all, Ramban doesn't bring this down, but if she's going to be a virgin, she already is a virgin, she's going to be a virgin 2 months, and that's all she needs to do, what does she need 2 months for? What is she going to do? She can't go with anybody, right? It's not that she could have one last fling, and all she does is walk around in the mountains crying for her virginity. So what does she need 2 months for? She could cry for her virginity in the tower as much as she could cry for her virginity. What is the need to ask for 2 months of reprieve time before whatever happens to her happens to her? But she asks for these 2 months. Her father says, okay. Vatasha Avia, she goes back to her father. Vayashla et nidro asher adani, does to her the swear that he swears. Vihilo yada'ish, and she did not know a man. That doesn't sound like she never knows a man. It means like she, after what he did, she had not known a man at that time. But to he chok be Israel, and it became a chok in Israel. What chok are you making? If it's a question of sending a girl to be a virgin, and you're going to make a big, every time you win a big battle, you'll take one of your daughters and you'll make a virgin monastery, a monk out of her, that's a chok be Israel? That's a disgusting thing, the Ramban says. Yamim yamin, it was from day to day. Telach nabo Yisrael tanot levat yiftach agiladi. They would cry for ba yiftach agiladi arba yamim mishna, 4 days in the thing. What are they coming to cry for? Every year, miyamim yamina, every year became a chok. This became a holiday of sorts, not a holiday, a tishabav. This was a tishabav of the time. every year they would say, this is what happened. So what are they upset about? If it's Kodesh, and if you're saying that you're doing a good thing, it's a good thing, but that's not the impression at all. They're coming to curse the situation. Let me continue on. V'ima davar kein bito abochel b'tulev re'otayim makzonot v'kales etnan. They're like prostitutes that are cursing her. I'm not exactly sure what the Ramban means. The chas v'chalila she'el chok b'Yisrael. Why in God, why would we, why heaven forbid that we should make a law in Israel, tanot ba yiftach ba yimisham if they shall only sell a baal. So she didn't get it. She didn't get married, so I make a 4-day holiday, a 4-day Yom Kippur, a 4-day Tisha B'Av. That's what I'm going to celebrate, I'm going to commemorate. Vayita avodat Hashem b'tara. If, you know, I don't know what she means. Aval hadavar kipshuto. It's like it says. V'tuto hayav imashe amarti. Si chashav kasher charam cherem nagid Yisrael chal v'kayam lamid anashim or over al-chamo chayam ita kim nadar be'et ha-melchama lasod ish el anashim zevach yechol ha-neder v'lo yadach yecherem el sanhedrin chal al-amodim v'chalotan etc. That's what he's saying is he made the promise in a rash act of war and he paid the price. And so
he paid the price?
Well, yes, we'll see, actually. Yes,
well,
you're right, she paid the price.
If he killed her.
He paid the nether, she paid the price.
Yeah,
actually, guys, if he killed her.
He would have probably suffered for that.
We'll see exactly what he does suffer, because again, the iron of all should always be on Malchut. And we'll see what that means in a second. We'll see why he does pay the price. Let me read you a little bit of Divrei Chazal so we can show you what they say. Hine Anochi, it's Bereshit Rabbah, line 20. Hine Anochi Nitzav Al Amayim Ubenot Anshei Ha'ir Hayan Nara Asher Amar Lecha. It's talking about Eliezer, who goes out to get a daughter, and he swears that the girl who comes out to meet him and offers the water to him and his camels, that's the one. Now that's how's that for a risk? How's that for a risk? What if she's married? You know, there's all kinds of questions here.
So I think one assumes that, I mean, he's asking
that
the one that
has
that.
Yes, and we understand that it shows that
one.
She
not
has the qualities. It's true, but it is. Or you could say that he made a nether, but by the very fact that the girl would do that, and only you could say that only unmarried girls went out to grab water from the well, just like Rachel came out to the well during Laman's time. So you could say that really he wasn't looking for any specific girl, he wasn't worried, and that was the midot that he wanted. Nonetheless, Chazal are not so amused. Chazal say there were four people. Arbi underlined on line 20, Dalad Hain Shetavu Shalo Kehogan. There are four people that demanded something of God inappropriately. Le'echad Nitain Shalo Kehogan. One was given as he asked inappropriately. That's Yiftach. Ve'elu Hain Eliezer Eved Avraham Kalev, who said, whoever wins this battle, I'm going to give this city to them. Shaul, because Shaul says, whoever beats these Plishtim, I'll give my daughter to marry. What if he wasn't Jewish? Say Chazal. And of course, Yiftach. Let's go down to you know what, I want to go down to line 44, because if I do everything we're not going to have enough time. 44 says Dalad Hain Shenidru, there are four that swore. Shnayim Shenadru V'Hifsidu, two swore and they lost. Ushnayim Nadru V'Nishtaku, and there are two that swore and they got paid back, they made money on it. Yaakov Nadar V'Hifsidu, Yaakov made a neder and he lost. What neder is it talking about? What was the loss?
Oh, to Lavan.
That I swear that nobody has your truffin. Rachel had the truffin and she died. That was the price that she paid. So therefore, the word hifshid has no question about its connotations. It means a loss of life and specifically of a loved one. Yiftach nadar, the hifshid, and he lost. Chana nadra v'nishtakras. Here's the connection with Chana the Chazal. Chana makes a promise and she gains. But her promise is totally different. She doesn't promise the life of somebody. She promises the devotion of somebody. The very swear itself is different. That's why she's paid back. Yisrael nadru v'nishtakru. And Israel also swore, this is when they went to battle with Arad, and they swore that if God gives them the hands, then we will make these things that we conquer in battle sacrifices to you. So all those things will make Chayim Hashem. So it wasn't just that the payback was different, the swear itself, and to a certain degree it's critical. But I don't want to criticize Yaakov at this point. I want to point out the word hitshid, chazal, and we could look at medrash, I could bring in medrash after medrash, Radak is telling the truth. There's no question that chazal believes that she was killed. And the truth is, I'd like you to take a look at the next page, if you can, and we'll finish in about 5 minutes. What Chazal say is ha ilu yatsa chamor o kelev echad o achatul echad is saying, how could Yiftach, remember, Radak's father, and the Eben Ezra put it in good light, Yiftach was covering all his bases. If an unkosher animal comes out, then I'll make it kodesh. If it's a kosher animal, oh, it automatically goes out? Okay, it's a little romantic, but I'm okay with it. Yiftach, I'm sorry, if a kosher animal comes out, I sacrifice it. So not only do they put it in an incredibly good light, Yiftach's a firm guy. Chazal do no such thing in that medrash that was on the first page. We'll do a little more of that medrash. It says the reason why he got paid back to punish his daughter, and I'm telling you, Chazal means to kill his daughter, to have to kill his daughter, is because he took a chance. They don't believe that the word was oh. They believe that's a copulative vav. That is, I will sacrifice whatever comes out. They weren't worried about human sacrifices, Chazal, but since he took a chance that he was going to sacrifice an unkosher animal, therefore they paid him back. But my question for you is, which means Chazal don't really raise the specter of a possibility of human sacrifice. They believe Yiftach Sin was taking a chance that he would sacrifice an unkosher animal, and therefore he's paid back. But I have a question for you. If you look at the simple pshat of the sukkah, and she comes out to greet him, let's take a look at the words in the pasuk. How does she come out and greet him? By Yavo Yiftach, this is in verse 34 of Shoftim. Well, you might say, by Yavo Yiftach HaMitzpal Beito, V'hinei Bito Yotzeit L'Krato, Bitupim uvim cholot. She comes out with drums and with dances. Barak hi yichida. She is by herself. Elomi menu benubat. Very difficult pasuk, but she comes out. Let's focus. She comes out with the tupim and the cholot. Ring a bell for anybody?
Miriam.
First of all, Miriam, and that's the first pasuk I brought for you. After the success, and you should know, it wasn't just the miracle. If you read Az Yashir, it's not just a miracle about splitting the sea. It's a miracle about being victorious over enemies. Hashem Gibor Milcha Hashem, how's it go? Hashem Ish Gibor Hashem Gibor Milcha Ma Chel Paro Yarav Ayam. It's about defeating the enemies. Yochzemo Raad Knan Az Nifalu Alufei Edom. It's about conquering the enemies. So Miriam does what people do, which is they take up the Tupim and Mecholot, and they sing the victorious victory of Jews in battle. Now, if I only had Az Yashir, I would be speculating. But I don't have only have Az Yashir. Let's take a look at the next pasuk. We have Shmuel Aleph. I'm now in Shmuel Aleph, so I'm on the second page of the notes. On line number 8, Shmuel Aleph, Perek 18. Vayhi b'voam, what happens is David kills Goliath. And after he kills Goliath, it was essentially a one-on-one combat. The Plishtim was supposed to give up afterwards. We'll get to there when we get to Shmuel Aleph. It was essentially one of those, instead of having all the enemies fight, we'll have a one-on-one, and whoever wins becomes servants to the other people. No surprise, when the Plishtim lost, they decided not to give in, and then they decided to run back to their home. David chases them and defeats the Plishtim over a period of time in great victorious battles. Saul is the king, David is his general of the armies, and it says, Vayhi b'voam, when they came back, b'shuv David me'akot et ha-plishti, when he came back defeating the Plishtim, v'teitsena ha-nashim, and the woman came out, mikol arei Yisrael, from every of the cities in Israel, lashur shir, lashur should be skipped, that's a Cree, and I agree, lashir v'amacholot, they sang, and they had their dances, v'krat sha'ol ha-melech b'tupim, v'shimchav v'shilishim. They came out with their tupim, their drums, and the mecholot, and they danced. It was a victorious battle, and what did they say? Of course, they sang a song. Atanena nashim hamishachikot, v'tomarna hikash Shaul ba'alafo. Shaul killed his thousands. The David, the Rivavotav, kills his tens of thousands. Of course, that's a total separate shiur, which we'll get to, believe that their next cycle. But as you can see, the custom seems to be that when you come back from battle, the women come pouring out, going, rock and roll, guys, you won. So I have a question. As we look back in the past, was it out of possibility that he could possibly expect that his daughter could come out? Chazal don't want to raise the specter. But Chazal somewhere else do raise the specter. Why? Because there was a concept of human sacrifice. What was it, of course? The famous Moloch. Mm-hmm. And Moloch was a god of who? The Ammonites. Ammon, the people he was battling. Milcom was one name of the god that Moloch, and Chamush and Milcom, or Moloch, was the other one. Now, I brought a whole bunch of psukim because if we had more time, I'd want to go to the issue. The rabbi actually raised it in his speech 2 weeks ago. Rabbi Sprung upstairs about sacrificing your kid. I don't know if anybody was there for the speech. It's a little more complicated than the rabbi presented because actually the Torah brings down two separate halachot. One is not passing your child, burning your child to Moloch, and the other one is not passing your child to fire, and they appear to be two separate forms of Avodah Zarah. One which causes the death of the child, and one which does not cause the death of the child. And I don't want to get into it because it's much more complicated. Yirmiyahu certainly ignores that. He combines both together. Sefer Malachim separates that. We could spend shirim on the whole thing of this form of sacrifice. But is it impossible to believe? Can we really say that he had no expectation that somebody in his house, he said, from my house, whoever comes out to greet me, I was expecting a hug from the dog? A hug from the cat? Kola Yotzei Lekrati, and he knows that when you win battles, women come out to sing and dance. Was it out of possibility that his daughter might come out?
You know what? If you're asking a chesed from Hashem, you don't expect Hashem to do you a dirty.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. I have a sneakier possibility of why he did. Not only that, what you're saying is very important. I'll tell you why.
Oh, for Christ.
I don't want to get rid of his wife.
There's no wife here at all. She's already kicked the bucket.
That's funny. By the way, and you have to, it's not so simple, obviously, because when his daughter does show up, he's very shocked, right?
Yeah.
We read the prophecy, it says, Achar achatani, you've ruined me. By the way, Achar is used when you really, when is it used? By Ochran, the guy who steals out of Yericho.
Mm-hmm.
And he says, Bameh achartanu, you have ruined the Jewish people. You've destroyed us. We'll never be able to defeat our enemies now. We're totally ruined. So he's shocked. On one hand, we got a problem. How can you say that he couldn't even imagine the possibility, knowing the custom of Jewish girls to come out and dance the glory? How could he have not expected it? And yet, we have to answer up the issue because his daughter comes out and he is totally shocked. So, yeah.
First of all, the process with Shmuel didn't happen yet in this time.
You're right.
Could be that there were, I don't know, 10, hundreds of years since the time of Yetzias Mitzrayim, and it hadn't been done since then?
True, but only about, from Yitzhak to the end, until David's time, Saul's time, you're dealing only with about 75 years. I agree that we can't prove just because there was a custom 250 years ago and a custom 70 years from then that women go singing battles. We cannot prove, there's no way, you're right, absolutely, there's no proof here that the women come out and sing and dance for the battle. The words are exactly the same. I mean, the words Tupim and Mecholot are the identical words. And Shmuel, of course, and the thing that I always feel is Shmuel's writing with his pen, with his kumos, with his feather pen, like a surgeon cuts with his scalpel. Precision words, and if words are used exactly from when it comes out in Cholot and the Tupim and it matches those two situations word for word, it makes you wonder.
But you have to ask the other thing that in the first case study, in the last case study, Yim and Turo went out to keep him in Cholot, and here it says she went out Turo to keep him. Now, one woman usually to one drum,
right?
So there were other women who went out with her?
Very possibly. And not only that, you're painting an important scenario that I want to paint before I give another possible answer. He doesn't have his own little house. He's the king. He's the king. He probably has multiple wives. If we follow the normal pattern from Gidon all the way to Ibshan and the rest, he's got, you think he has multiple kids, got multiple wives.
But he doesn't.
We'll have to analyze that. That's the difficult passage.
Well,
because the word is wrong. No, it says Ein lo mimenu. If she was the only one, it should have been Ein lo mimena. She was the only one. When it says Ein lo mimenu, it means she's the only one he has from him or them. It's an incredibly difficult passage from a grammatical sense.
But then it goes on.
The Hilavadai Ein Lo Od Mimenu. Very difficult puzzle. I'll get to that in a second. But even if he doesn't have daughters and sons, he certainly has carriers on. He's got Avdei HaMelech. He's got Am Haaretz. He's not, when you think of his house, he doesn't have a house. He's got a castle. He's the king. They made him the king of Gilead. You can't imagine one guy with one girl. That's not the scenario here. And if he wasn't such an important guy, he wouldn't have girls. It wasn't like they were her B'nai Kiva friends that came to make a... And they made a choke. You know, they made a rule about this. He's the king. He makes the rules. You know, the golden rule. Whoever has the gold makes the rules. So now I'll give you this possible sneaky answer. He made the neder before Hesia. Whoever comes out of my house first, that person or thing I'll sacrifice to God. Why was he shocked? Because if he made the neder in public before he went to battle, what was he not expecting?
His daughter.
He was not expecting his daughter to come out. That's a possible answer, which means he wanted his daughter. There were plenty of people to come and sing his songs. I'm not convinced he was waiting for animals. I'm not convinced that Yitzhak was beyond the idea of a human sacrifice. I'm not convinced of that. Yitzhak was a bad guy, and I don't think we necessarily have to absolve him. But whatever he does with this person, he is shocked at his daughter, and yet he seems to want somebody to come out of his beito. But beito doesn't mean his own personal house, where he usually has a kitchen and three bedrooms and one toilet. Beito is his castle, his hangers-on. I think he expected his daughter to stay inside where she belonged, because they knew about the neder. She made a neder for Farhesia. If it wasn't a neder for Farhesia, you wouldn't even have to keep it. You have to make a neder. When you make a neder Hashem, I'm not sure, I should have looked it up luckily. I think there have to be Adim, you have to do in front of Beit Din. You can't just say, oh, I swear to God, etc., etc. Otherwise, it probably could be easily be Mayfair. This, if the king makes a neder, everybody hears it. Not only that, the king makes a neder to rally the forces, right? If God will give them everybody to me, because if God gives them, I promise I'll do the following thing. Certainly people heard. So if his daughter hears, why didn't she stay in the house? And what's that? That's a good question. Well, it could be that he made it to his house, but he wasn't expecting anybody from his direct house to come out. Whoever popped out of his castle, that unlucky person would be the issue. Or, by the way, maybe he wanted somebody to sacrifice themselves, and the daughter said, no, I'm going. The daughter seems very well ready to pay the price, because the daughter seems very firm here. In fact, we're running out of time. I could bring you down Midrashim with the daughter. What does it mean, Vayared El Haharim? It should say Va'alot El Haharim. She goes up there. Vayared El Haharim, she went to Beit Din. And she argues with Beit Din. She says, how come you can't be made for the neder? And she's having a machloket. The Chazal presenter as a Talmud Chacham was trying to use the laws of the Torah to extract herself from this difficult situation. He presents her in a very positive light. I believe she fully accepts it, because I believe that she felt that her personal sacrifice would guarantee the success of the battle. He didn't want her to go, and here's where I want to get into that difficult pasuk. Lo yatsa ein od levada. Sorry, let's read the pasuk aside so I don't make a mistake. Rak hi yichida, in the end of pasuk 34, she is by herself. Ein lo mimenu beinobat. He has nobody else from him or from them or from it, another son or daughter. Very difficult. So I'll tell you what the Radak says. He changes mimenu to mimenna, his sole daughter. The other possibility is he had one legitimate wife. Because as we see, there's a whole issue of pelugshin. That is, from his lineage, he had one daughter. That was his claim to, and here's where I want to get into the Malchut, and then I'll close up the shir, even though we could talk about a lot more stuff, and I'll mention a few things just to let you ponder, but I want to close up the shir. We see with the next shoftim that they not only have children, but they also have what? Grandchildren, right? 30 children, 40 grandchildren, because everything that a king needs is lineage. Mm-hmm. When she goes, whether you argue that she was the only one, which I'll accept, or whether you could argue, what do you mean, Edom Mimenu, who's the special Mimenu? So you could argue that it's the legitimate wife, the wife that guarantees an heir. So he only has a daughter. And his whole job is a king, because he ain't a king unless you have an heir. So if I don't have a son this time, I'll marry her off to somebody, which is what happened when he took his wife. And then, we'll be closing up in a few minutes, and then she'll have a grandson, hopefully, and we'll continue the line. When he says, Bameh achartani, you've ruined me, I think if you look at it in the sense of kingship, I was supposed to be the king. I bargained for this kingship. I did everything I was supposed to do. You were supposed to stay at home and have kids, stay at home and get married. And the only claim I had, my one little girl, to lineage is destroyed. I don't think he cares about her so much, although maybe that too. But he cares about himself. How do I know that? Because he doesn't say, look what you did to yourself. Bameh achartani, look what you did to me. I believe those are the words. When she comes out of the house, Vayicharota vayikrat v'gadav. Look what he does. He rips his clothes in mourning. Vayomer aha. That's the way you pronounce that, by the way. I'm peeking the hay. Aha. Aha. Biti hachra hichratani. Look what you did to me. Vatayita b'ochrai. And you were my ruination. Vanochi patsiti pel Hashem lo chalashuv. I made a promise. Aha. He's not focused on her. He's not care about her. He cares about himself. Because kingship is a self divinity. If you don't have an heir, you don't have a kingship.
Well, if he were the king, then he could get additional wives. So
Yeah, you would think so. Yeah, it's true. It's true. Why is he so desperate? Why not? And by the way, we see that he never does, by the way. No word of his kids, no words of any lineage. He disappears. So the assumption is that he never really does, otherwise we'd have some kind of recollection of him. By all the other kings, we know exactly how many children they have. It mentions from Gidon on, we know everyone and who the children are, if they had children. No, if they have children, so he wasn't mentioned. Here, there are no mentioned children. So you could say he just didn't mention him, and people reject him as a king, and this whole ball of yarn that I'm telling you is not accurate. Or he could say that for whatever reason he was unable to have any more kids. If you want to go to a Radak thing, maybe he was an older guy already and he had his one daughter and that was his claim to fame and then she was gone. Of course, then you have to sort of amend the text from Mimeno to Mimena. And I can tell you, not only did the Radak amend the text, but the Masoretes, the one who wrote the scrolls in the 800s or 900s, they amended the text. What they wrote in the little margins, if you're familiar with Masoretic texts, they write in the margins of the text all kinds of little codes. Most of those codes just tell you how to spell a word correctly, vowels. Sometimes they give a perish. This one is a perish. It says vav savir hay, which means don't read the vav, replace it with a hay. It's not a real Korean ktiv, but even though it looks like a vav, replace it with a hay, and she was his lone child, and she ruins herself. Either way, Chazal, I believe, are correct. I believe she sacrifices herself, and then why the focus of the betulah? Because she was a virgin, and she did not have any kids. Therefore, there's no lineage, and that's why Shmuel's interested in her virginity. Because the fact that she has to go away or is killed, either way you want to have it, you can translate either way. The fact that she's a virgin, the problem is that she's a virgin. The reason for making a chok in Yisrael is that the kingship is interrupted, and that may be the reason. No matter how you want to go, whether you want to say that she was killed or whether you want to say she got put into a monastery, I prefer Chazal's way. I don't have Radak's problems because I think the focus on the Ptulah, where Radak was trying to say, prove that she wasn't killed, Pumfaket is the other way. The focus on the Ptulah is because she was killed as a Ptulah, and therefore she never had a chance to have kids, and therefore Yiftach is Achar Achata. And that's, I think, essentially what's going on. You can go either way, and these are the various Mepharshim, and there's things to think about. Just to give you some things, other things to think about, the humans, the idea of sacrificing humans should immediately remind you of some other human sacrifice, which Akeda. Is, what?
Akeda.
And I can tell you right now that actually she is compared to, she, Yiftach's daughter, compared to Sarah.
Mm-hmm.
The famous story about Sarah, that Sarah and Avram didn't communicate.
Mm-hmm.
Avram comes back, and Chazal paints this very sad conversation, and while she's still telling him off for being ready to sacrifice their son, she has a heart attack. She simply dies in the middle of the conversation. There's another Chazal that talks about Samael, which was an evil malach, that came to try to trick Avraham to not do the sacrifice, and then it tried to trick Yitzchak to not do the sacrifice. All fascinating stuff, and Chazal used a very interesting word to tie the two together, but that certainly needs some thought. Also, I can tell you one other concept. If you remember when it says, it was every year they went out to sing her, those words really only appear one other place in the narrative part in the Torah. That would be by Shmuel, where it says his mother came b'yamim b'yamima. Always, it says his father came yamim yamima to give sacrifices. That's in chapter Aleph of chapter 1 of Shmuel Aleph, and in chapter 2 where he's already become a man of God, it says by he yamim yamima she brings him up clothes and teaches him and works with him on a daily basis. So the word yamim yamima actually appears twice there once again. So a further study of this, which we're not going to do now, you really need to compare. You know, Chazal made a connection between Sarah and Bat Yiftach, and that's tough. You really have to think and philosophize about that, and I don't have any answers right now, but it's something that, if you want to know what Chazal meant and how they interpret Torah, it's important to think about, and it's also important to think about there, because there it's also not perfectly the same, because it was his mother that made the swear on the son, and here it's the father on the daughter, so it's not exactly the same, and therefore, there's what to think about in those two cases, and that's where I would take further study if you want to know more about the story. Next week in Mir Shem we will have Shir. I'll tell people about what I'm doing on Shavuot, and next week we'll start Shimshon and we'll get to do the whole Malach situation with his mother and his father. Have a good night, and I'm sorry for keeping you as late as I did.
Excuse me.
Yeah.
The story of Tzubakar.
Yeah.
Doesn't that use that?
I thought Tzubakar by Hami Amimi Amima.
Yeah, I mean it's sort of. The concept is the same, I mean, and they still do it.